We're back. The pod has returned.
The pod hath returned. A little bit earlier than anticipated, which is a good thing, I think.
I think so. I mean, you had your sojourn in Europe.
Yes, I've been overseas in Europe. I was supposed to get back in February, but I'm back before the new year even came in. But I'm very glad to be back, and I'm very glad to be doing a podcast.
We're too committed to the grind.
Yeah, that's why I came back. I was like, I just don't know if I can be away from Ideas Matter for that long.
This is the dedication that we have for you guys.
Exactly.
Please send us donations, write us into your will, bequeath your estate to us.
Yeah.
Because we do these things for you.
Put us on all legal documents.
Give us power of attorney.
Yeah. Trust. Can't go wrong. But I actually noticed our Spotify, I mean, because you use Apple Music, but I use Spotify, and our podcast page on there's now got, I think, 19 reviews.
Nice.
And we dropped briefly down to a 4.7, but now we're at 4.8. But thank you to all of those listeners who've been rating us. It actually truly helps promote the visibility of the podcast.
Please keep those ratings going on. And also, if you're on Apple Podcasts, give us a rate on there as well.
Yeah. Please rate, share, reach out to us. We are very, very responsive to people who reach out to us.
Tell your extended family about us over Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Christmas is a good time to promote the podcast.
And then they'll say, oh, that sounds nice. They never look into it.
Yeah.
But look, the more you do that, the more you're going to get someone who actually will look at it.
That's very true.
Please, shill it for us.
Shill it. And Christmas is an apt time to share the pod because we are today talking about love.
Love, actually.
Love, actually. Yeah, we're talking about love, actually. Yeah, no, we're talking about love, and which actually is quite fortuitous because someone reached out on Instagram and said, can you guys do an episode on love?
Damn, I never knew that.
And when you wanted to do Symposium, I said, yeah, cool, short book, no worries. I had no idea it was the Platonic dialogue about love.
I mean, I came into this because, one, it's a short one, and two, I feel like it links up really well with St. Augustine, which we just looked at.
Mm.
Also allows us to like look at a bit of Plato. So very fortuitous on multiple angles.
Yeah, that's true. So everything sort of works out nicely. So for those of you who have listened to the Augustine episode, you will remember that basically the way that he interprets the Bible, not just him obviously, but really has left quite a lasting legacy on Western Christianity, is that the Bible gets interpreted through the lens of Neoplatonism. So it is quite interesting to go back and read Plato. Obviously, Platonism and Neoplatonism are slightly different, but still, to go back and read Plato, and particularly this dialogue which touches on the idea of the forms, it will be a very good supplement, as you said, to Augustine.
Mm. And also, I felt like this was his funniest dialogue. This was definitely the most entertaining of Plato's dialogues.
It was actually quite funny. I didn't expect it.
Yeah, like there's a lot of joking around, et cetera. Symposium means like a sort of drinking party.
Mm.
So it's set around Socrates and a bunch of prominent Athenians of his time getting together for a bit of a piss up and having a talk. And then they get gate crashed at the end by some very drunk, rowdy guy who upends the whole discussion.
Who's mad that Socrates won't sleep with him.
Yeah, which feeds into the ideas discussed.
Very much so.
Listen in to find out why that dude is mad that Socrates wouldn't sleep with him.
Yeah, sounds weird, doesn't it? Literally on page 3, like the dialogue starts with these two people walking, and he goes, oh, I heard you at this party with Socrates. Can you please recount what was said? I really want to hear his thoughts. And discussing, and one of them says, when I hear other kinds of discussion, especially the talk of rich businessmen like you, I get bored and feel sorry for you and your friends because you think you're doing something important when you're not. Perhaps you regard me as a failure, and I think you're right, but I don't think you're a failure. I know you are.
And the guy just replies like, dude, you're such a dick. Can you stop being a dick?
Yeah, literally, stop paying out on me. Just tell me what Socrates said at this party. But it's quite funny because reading it, I was like, yeah, well, as someone who studied philosophy, and you always get that person who, you know, did their business degree or their commerce degree, and they're like, well, what are you going to do with philosophy? It's so pointless. I just love this retort as well. I don't think you're a failure. I know you are.
Smackdown versus Raw.
Maybe we should get into the content.
What is it about?
What is this about? Well, it's about love, and it's about Eros, to be exact, Greek god or Greek spirit, depending on who you listen to in the dialogue. But it really begins at this party, at this symposium. Was it Phaedrus who laments that no one writes eulogies or no one praises the god love as much as the other gods?
I believe so. That's how they start up the discussion. So there's, it's all the people in here are like prominent Athenians who actually existed. I guess you could see that there's a sort of satirical aspect to it.
Yeah, it's a very satirical text, yeah.
Because he kind of takes the people and parodies or does like some exaggeration of who they are and the kind of things they would think based on who they are. Like he there's a doctor character and he gives him like a real sort of medical explanation, and there's like a comedic playwright and he gives him a speech that kind of sounds like he's taking the piss. But yeah, they're talking about Eros, which specifically is sort of like romantic love and like erotic desire. It's like a love for another person romantically and sexually. It's a bit tricky when you read the text because it keeps on talking about love, but that has a sort of that has implications and associations in English that aren't necessarily the same as the Greek term and concept of eros.
Yeah, because as you just said, it also includes desire.
Yeah, so this isn't, you wouldn't talk about like your eros for your like your kids.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I made a note of that because I was sort of like, why? This really just seems like they're making a very basic mistake conflating love and desire. Because there's a bit in the text where they're saying, well, no one loves what they have. I'm like, well, that's not true, because then you wouldn't love your partner.
Yeah.
But what they mean is no one desires what they don't have. Desire is something that you want.
Yeah.
So that's that sort of, yeah, the fact that the concept is actually referring to what we would distinguish between two separate things. So just bear that in mind if you're wondering why we might say something that sounds odd. So they're at this symposium and there's these prominent Athenians, as Alex has said. Socrates walks in. After being held up, he sees something and he just sort of stands out there on the street for, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes. Just they have to send the slaves to go get him. And here Socrates comes in and they say, oh, Socrates, come sit down, sit next to me so I can absorb your wisdom. And so they're all sitting around on this couch and basically they take it in turns to give speeches about what they think love is and how good love is. And they sort of follow the order of the people sitting on the couch. So that's sort of the structure of the dialogue. I'm not going to focus too much on who said what because I'm going to butcher the Greek names. So really they begin. Do you know who starts off this dialogue?
Yeah, it starts off, they sort of agree like, okay, everybody let's give a speech in praise of Eros, the god of romantic love and desire, because he doesn't get his props. So let's all take turns and see what angles we can come at Eros from.
Yeah.
So it starts off with Phaedrus, who is like an aristocrat of the time, who would have been familiar to Socrates. Like there's a Platonic dialogue called Phaedrus in which he also plays a character. So Phaedrus starts out talking about Hesiod, which is a very classical ancient Greek poet, like around the same time as Homer, famous for his work called Theogony, where he talks about like the gods and like Greek myth, and it sort of sets the template for all later discussions of it. Claims from Hesiod that love was the third thing to come into existence after chaos and earth. So this is sort of like a mythological view. Actually, I just want to note here that I think there's an interesting pattern through here where a lot of the earlier people in the dialogue they treat love in these sort of mythological terms, like with reference to like Hesiod and Homer, and when we get to Aristophanes, he sort of gives his own mythology of how love and human nature started. And then we can see when we get to Socrates, he's rejecting that sort of like mythic understanding, and he gets into this like sort of rational philosophical understanding of what love is.
Yeah.
So I thought that's something interesting to keep in mind, because these earlier mythical things, they're there for a reason, and you can sort of see this as a this sort of development within Greek culture at the time, from that earlier mythic understanding towards the later sort of like rational philosophical understanding brought forward by like Socrates and Plato. Like this is sort of like a vision of like cultural developments. So yeah, like Phaedrus gives this sort of like mythical understanding of love through Hesiod. So there's like things that are created. There's like chaos and earth. I think it's important that, you know, there's the mention of chaos here, because that sort of implies that there's like the first thing into existence was chaos. That's the first thing that comes into being in like the ancient Greek mythos, which is also sort of a claim that there's an element to the universe, there's an element to the world that's like fundamentally irrational. And of course, when we get to Socrates, we're going to see that he argues heavily against that. Like, no, like the universe is structured in a rational way that we can come to understand. So it starts out, okay, there's chaos, there's earth, and then there's love. Those are the first three things in existence. And then Phaedrus goes on to say that love is the most powerful influence in a person's life, because it produces, quote, a sense of shame at acting disgracefully and pride in acting well in the eyes of a lover. So it's, love is important because it makes you seek virtue. And he gives this good example of ancient Greek city-states that would be structured around sort of like citizen armies, where you would be like a hoplite. A hoplite is a sort of, it's sort of like an infantryman that you would be if you were a Greek citizen. And he says that hoplites are more likely to act bravely and kind of fight away their cowardice in battle if their boyfriend is there witnessing them on the battlefield. So love allows them to do like virtuous things, like be brave and, I don't know, any other such virtues, because you want to impress who it is that you're in love with. So that's why love is good. And that's essentially Phaedrus's speech, where he just goes into this idea of, you know, the virtues of love and why it's important for you to impress other people in this way.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I didn't pick up on the sort of the transition from the mythical understanding to the more rational understanding. So that's really interesting to see.
I wouldn't have picked that up on the first reads, but I read this before you went to Europe, and then I just read it again to take my notes for this pod. And it was only then that I picked it up. Like, oh, damn, that is something in there.
Well, very much so. Yeah, that's fascinating. And for those of you who are familiar with how Platonic dialogues are structured, like at the beginning of the dialogue, you get all these views presented, and they sort of do a really good job at sort of reeling you in. You go, I agree with that. That makes sense. And then a character comes along and just completely demolishes it. So it's sort of this process of like you're being built up to believe this thing, and then it gets knocked down, and you're never quite sure what you're actually supposed to think. But that's the dialectical method, right? And so, and the reason why I bring that up is because all these views of love that precede Socrates' speech at the end, although he ultimately sort of knocks them down, I personally thought there was a lot in these early speeches that like I liked and I thought was valid, at least in a sort of like not crude, but like non-intellectual way, like a way of understanding this idea of love. I mean, I agree. Like, I think in my notes I wrote, love is the most effective at making people lead good lives. And as you said, it's both through a sense of shame at wrong actions and a pride in doing good. And I just sort of think about this in terms of how if you have someone that you love, or people that you love in general, it just makes intuitive sense to me that, yeah, well, that is what will want to cause you to lead a good life, because you're not living for yourself. You're living for others. And you gave an example of like the military, like people who are fighting for a cause they actually believe in, fighting for a country that they love. You know, they're going to be more effective fighters than people who are perhaps doing it out of fear. And to give an even more sort of pedestrian example, like sports psychology, we know very much that like positive reinforcement is way more effective than like negative reinforcement, for example. Mm. So I just thought there was a lot in these early speeches that actually rang true to me. And I do agree that, yeah, like love, maybe it's not the most effective, but I think, yeah, it is a huge motivator for people to lead good lives.
Mm. Yeah, and it touches on that. Are you familiar with Viktor Frankl?
A Man's Search for Meaning.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, Viktor Frankl is like a Jewish-Austrian psychologist who got sent to Auschwitz and survived. And when he came out of Auschwitz, he wrote a book on sort of like psychotherapy theory and sort of drawing on his experiences in Auschwitz and in detailing why he thought what he thought. And he noted that people in Auschwitz who gave themselves some sense of meaning, like some reason to survive, were more likely to actually stay alive. And it was people who gave up and thought, no, this is all completely useless. There's no point in any of this. They were more likely to lose their willpower and die in Auschwitz. Mm. And Viktor Frankl's example was he got split off from his wife and it was in his mind the entire time he was in Auschwitz, I need to survive so I can get to see my wife again and see that she's okay.
Yeah.
Tragically, it turned out that a few days after they got split off, she got killed.
Oh.
She got exterminated. But that was what helped him through it. There's also that Nietzsche quote, a man with a why can bear almost any how.
Yeah,
I feel like that's what Phaedrus is indicating in his
exactly
his part of the dialogue.
It is definitely what he's indicating, and they sort of talk about how it's only love that makes someone willing to die for another person.
Yeah,
and I think that's absolutely 100% true. Like people would sacrifice themselves for their kids, or they would sacrifice themselves for their partner. Mm. I mean, I think even if this is ultimately a slightly pedestrian view of love that Socrates is going to later come along and say, no, that's not really love per se, blah, blah, blah. Still, there's a lot to be said for these early speeches, I think.
Yeah, and one thing worth noting before we go on is that Phaedrus introduces the idea of like the dichotomy between like a lover and a boyfriend.
Yeah.
So to keep in mind, homosexuality was something that was, at least in these like aristocratic ancient Greek circles, was something that was considered like virtuous. Like it's better to have a male lover than it is to have a female lover. And they draw on this dynamic of like you have a lover and a boyfriend, at least that's how it's translated. So you have someone in the relationship who's older and someone in the relationship who's younger. And it's in Phaedrus's dialogue that this gets introduced, but it gets developed as we go on.
Mm. Yeah. So I mean, it is literally as it sounds, like a lover is like an older male and a boyfriend is like generally...
A boyfriend.
Yeah, literally, like not a man, like a prepubescent child.
They do mention later on that it's better to love boys who...
Have a beard,
so...
But even then, like, you can get a beard at like 14, 15, so...
Especially if, you know, Greek people... Yeah. That Mediterranean genetics.
True, that's true.
Yeah, we don't know how old they mean when they say with a beard. But
yeah, exactly.
Probably not like a 7-year-old.
Yeah,
which is good.
It's fascinating though because you know, like I think a lot about this concept of like progress, right, and sort of linear ideas of time. And in sort of one sense, the Greeks are ahead of us in not having negative views towards homosexuality, and this was thousands of years ago, and then come into Christianity, that gets reversed. So in that sense, you might say they're ahead, although I'm doing air quotes, guys, because I don't believe in progress. But then on the other hand, they accept homosexuality, which is good, but then they have this sort of bizarre, I mean, it is like child molestation, really.
Yeah. Their phrase for it would be pederasty.
Yeah. And they sort of, it's odd because they sort of admit that like, people in this Greek society judge the boys.
Mm.
Like they think it's bad for a boyfriend to have a lover, but they think it's good for a lover to have a boyfriend.
Yeah, because this is like a hyper-masculine society.
Yeah.
So by being the younger one, like is sort of by definition in these relationships being the submissive one in the relationship, and that is viewed as being feminine.
Yeah.
So it's good to have the masculine role. They look up on that. But if you take the feminine role, I mean, there's discussion in here about how you can take that, well, I say feminine in quotes, but, you know, take the submissive role in this homosexual relationship and have that be a virtuous thing because you're developed intellectually and, like, your character is developed by your older lover. But, yeah, there's also discussion of the conditions in which that's not the case.
Okay, that's a perfect lead-in.
It's bad to get played.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually a perfect segue to the next speaker, because the next speaker comes along and says, if there's anyone listening to this who knows Greek names, I'm sorry. Pausanias? Pausanias?
I don't know. I was going to say Pausanias.
Pausanias? That sounds kind of, I don't know, antiquitous.
Apparently a sort of legal expert at the time.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, they come along and they say something really interesting. It goes, firstly, love is not a single thing. There are different kinds of love. But secondly, nothing is inherently right or wrong. It depends on how it's done, which I think is a really interesting point.
Very, you might say, proto-Nietzschean.
Yeah, proto-Nietzschean.
Sort of in like the sophist tradition of ancient Greece.
Yeah, and I sort of think also about Confucius, about how sort of intentionality is what gives something its morality.
Right, right.
It's not just looking after people. Like, so sort of Confucius says, well, it's not just merely looking after your parents that makes you virtuous, because we look after our horses. Anyone can look. It's about how you do. Do you have a mindset of reverence and respect for the thing that you are looking after? So it's actually the mindset that makes something moral. So that's interesting. But to go back what we were talking about before, they have this entire discussion about, well, when is it okay to gratify your lover? And so they quite literally mean, like, when is it okay for a boyfriend to perform sexual favors for this older man?
Yeah, when are you going to give out?
Yeah, when are you going to give out? And they agree that it's why you're doing it. So if a boyfriend agrees to basically see this lover because they think they're rich and powerful, that's bad, because they're performing sexual favors because they want riches, they want power, and ultimately these things are not virtuous, they're fleeting, etc. On the other hand, if you gratify your sexual partner because you think that they're a virtuous person and you could learn from them, you can be educated by them and learn how to be virtuous, even if that ends up not being the case, even if you get played by this person, well, then that reveals something about your own character, because you weren't seeking riches, you were seeking virtue. So it's okay to gratify your lover for the right reasons. Bizarre example, but the idea that something's not inherently right or wrong, it's for what end are you doing it, is, I think, interesting.
Yeah, and it's... I thought this was a very interesting part of the dialogue. He does introduce this idea, Pausanias, of like the distinction between what he calls like common love and heavenly love. So he says like common love is for inferior people. Also, common love is people who are attracted to women as much as boys and attracted to bodies rather than minds.
Yeah.
Which kind of gets the revealing of the Greek gender dynamics there.
Yeah.
So if you seek a woman as a lover, then that's inherently a lower form of love, because they're less capable of rationality.
Yeah, because they're supposedly not as intelligent. Right. You must love them for their body.
Yeah.
Right, but that's just common love, and that's bad, because, I mean, this gets back to the sort of the stuff that we touched on in Augustine, and it's sort of throughout all of ancient Greek philosophy, is that the material world, the world of appearances, right, is less real because it's fleeting. So if you think it's somewhat arbitrary to say that, oh, well, being attracted to the body is bad and to the mind is good, it's because that, you know, the body breaks down, we age and we stop being physically beautiful. And so it's fleeting. It's in some sense less real. Whereas the mind is this higher faculty which is capable of transcending this world of appearances. Mm. And so if you're in love with that, you're in love with this part of the world that is, in a sense, more real.
Yeah.
And that's why it's more virtuous to love the mind than the body.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I feel like, you know, we can sort of extend this distinction between the common and heavenly love to the modern day. We can go, okay, like, we can set aside that part about women as sort of incidental, but what he's getting at here when we try to remove his idea from the cultural context of his time, which, on the one hand, to what extent can you even do that? But on the other hand, let's take this idea as it is and try to apply it to the modern day. Common love is like desire oriented. Like, it's, you know, you love for the Tinder smash
Exactly.
You're not actually that into the person as a person.
Yeah.
And he notes as well that like the intelligence of the partner is unimportant. You're not in it for who they are as a brain, as a mind, as a character. You're just, bro, she's hot.
Yeah.
Dude, she's mint.
Yeah, legit.
Yeah. And also like it's the good behavior of the person is unimportant as well. So it's with no reference to intelligence or character. It's purely just like a base physical desire. So remember, like,
yeah, that's what I meant before about the confusion between, because we would not,
yeah,
we wouldn't call that love.
Yeah, so it's important to keep in mind, like, when they say love here, it's eros, like romantic love and erotic desire.
Yeah, so we would just consider this, like, I mean, the Tinder example is a good one. Like, you might fall in love with someone that you meet on Tinder, but if you're just doing it for like sexual gratification, no one is going to say, well, that's an instance of love.
Yeah. Then he goes on to heavenly love, which I feel is interesting because on the one hand, he says it's only really directed at boys, which we would see as being not too great today.
No.
But he makes a note of saying it's unabusive, non-manipulative, which... I don't know, you can get into the dynamics of that when you're talking about, like, pubescent people.
Clearly it is manipulative, but anyway.
But yeah, I think the idea is, like, you're not seeking to, like, actively manipulate the person to, like, be attracted to you or, like, get sexual gratification out of them. It's, like, you have an aim of, like, a fully shared life and, like, an interplay of, like, character.
Yeah.
You're trying to cultivate the virtue of that person and through that, cultivate your own virtue, and you're trying to like have like an intellectual exchange with that person. And there's this very interesting example he gives where he talks about the sort of virtues of this and why certain governments don't want this sort of virtue. And he says the Persian government, so keep in mind this is, you know, talking about ancient Persia, condemns love affairs. It doesn't specify in what sense, but you can assume love affairs between unmarried men and boys. Condemns love affairs, intellectual activities like setting up an academy or something, and athletic activities. Quote, no doubt it doesn't suit their government that their subjects should have big ideas or develop strong friendships and personal bonds, which are promoted by all these activities, especially by love. So I feel like this is important because it stresses the sort of cultural connection in ancient Athens and ancient Greece, at least, between sort of like physical excellence, intellectual excellence, and love, which they all sort of see as being part of living a good life. So,
yeah,
it's important for them that you know, be ripped as well.
Yeah, you can't really. That's what I love so much about ancient philosophy is that it's a much more holistic philosophy. And it is, I mean, so I guess there's like two senses of the word in which we might use philosophy today. There's like academic philosophy, and then there's like, oh, well, what is your life philosophy?
Yeah.
And people who are into like people who use the word philosophy and like, well, what is your philosophy of life? Those kind of people are more sort of attracted towards things like Stoicism and these like ancient philosophies for good reason, I think, because they have a much more holistic understanding of life. And it is actually about, or how do we live a good life, a happy life? How can we be flourishing human beings? And so they have that holistic approach. And it's, yes, you need to engage in philosophy and debate and you need to exercise your mind, but you also need to exercise your body. And again, this is like pre-Descartes, right? So it's sort of these things aren't siloed off from one another. They're not viewed as separate things. Like to do one, you have to do the other. And like, for example, was it Plato's Academy that where you would do philosophy and you would learn wrestling?
Yeah.
It's just fucking awesome.
Yeah. You'd train and then you'd engage in intellectual pursuits.
Yeah, I mean, like I love martial arts. So that's just such a, I wish that still existed. Like you could go to like a martial arts academy and then have like philosophical debate. That's awesome.
I'd sign up. But, this is a really important part of ancient Greek culture, which I find very interesting and admirable, which is the idea that, for like excellence of character, to be an excellent person, you need bodily, like physical excellence as well as like mental excellence.
Yeah.
Like those go hand in hand. If you have one without the other, you're like necessarily deficient as a character.
Yeah. And look, it's very like prescient because we know that physical exercise actually improves the function of your brain.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been writing something, for example, and you get stuck, you get writer's block, and then I go for a run, and then I'll come back and I'll sit down again, and it just comes out. Just comes out. Because you're literally, because your brain gets oxygenated. So the Greeks are onto something.
So that about sums up Pausanias's segment of the dialogue. So just to recap, brings in this distinction between common love and heavenly love. So one's lower, one's just sort of like base erotic desire. The other one is like intellectual, it's based on character, and it's not coercive or manipulative either. It's centered toward virtue. Is there anything else you wanted to mention for Pausanias?
No, my notes are not as detailed as yours. That's pretty much all I had. And then because I can't pronounce the names, I, in my notes, refer to the next speaker as Dr. Man.
I'll give an attempt. Eryximachus, who is a famous physician of the time.
Yeah. This honestly confused me the most. I didn't really understand what he was going on about, because he just sort of seemed to stretch the concept of love so far that at that point, are you really talking about love anymore?
Mm.
He says love manifests in everything. And so, like, I mean, I guess it's probably easy to understand if you think of also the dual meaning of desire, because he's like, the sick part of your body desires things and the healthy part of your body desires things, and which one you feed in medicine, and this is a very pre-modern understanding of medicine, but which one you feed determines your health. Because so there's love everywhere. Mm. And then he talks about, like, chaos in the universe is also a form of love. But it's like bad love. It's like chaos and discord. But then there's good love, which is like harmony. And he gives examples of music and self-control and justice. And he concludes by saying that love marked by self-control and justice is, quote, the source of all our happiness. So he too thinks there are different kinds of love, but only one kind, that which is marked by self-control and justice and harmony, etc. That's what gives us happiness. And I guess right. that is easier to understand when you think that this also means desire.
Mm. I mean, I see Eryximachus as part of the dialogue as like another step in that, you might say, like, theme throughout the entire dialogue of the move from like a mythical understanding of the universe and human character into like the more rational philosophical one. Because like, yeah, he has what sounds like a very alien notion to us now, which is love is sort of like a physical process, like something that's like an aspect of the universe that happens in, like, say, like the bodily responses of animals or like plants growing in the earth. Love exists in virtually everything that exists, which is his quote, which doesn't make much sense when we consider like our understanding of like romantic love and erotic desire. But I think it's important to hark back to that first speech where he opens with Hesiod saying that chaos came first into existence and then earth and then love, which is eros. So we can view love in this sense that he's talking about it, not just as a god, but some like deep sort of primordial force.
Yeah.
It's something that is like frames their mythic understanding of the world. And because it's this primordial force, we can see it undergirding everything. So like stripping away the romantic aspect, we can look at the desire-based aspect as something that begets new things. It's like the process of reproduction and growth and development from one thing to another. And when you look at it in that sense as this like primordial force undergirding the universe and reality, then it makes sense in Eryximachus's view why love is present in things that don't really have much of like don't have anything of like a romantic bent to them.
Yeah.
So like plants growing, like
it's almost like a teleology. It's a force that's making things move.
Yeah. It's like a primordial force, yeah. Pretty much. Which is odd as a philosophical argument, but it's steeped in this ancient Greek mythic understanding.
Well, that's interesting because I read just last week, I read Meditations, Marcus Aurelius, and the introduction, I can't remember who wrote it, sorry, but it was like quite good and sort of gives a broader, because obviously Marcus Aurelius sort of comes after Plato. So he's obviously read Plato. And it's talking about how one of the problems in ancient Greek philosophy was the problem of, quote, the one and the many. And really, that's what we would call today like metaphysics or ontology. And like when we look at the world, we see this multiplicity of things. We see all these different things. And the Greeks, ancient Greeks, wanted to know, well, is the universe comprised of fundamentally different things, or underneath all of that is there just one thing? And everything really just stems from that. And so what you were saying earlier about how this dialogue sort of progresses structurally away from the mythic understanding towards a more rational understanding is, and by the time you get to the Stoics, you've gone so far that, like, yes, the universe is rational and it's just one singular rational force, whatever you want to call it. In Confucianism or Taoism, you'd call it the way. In Christianity, you might call it providence, or you just call it reason, right? But there is a rational thread that runs through the universe, and that basically, it is kind of like a primordial force, as you were saying. So yeah, you can see in this this doctor's speech, there's that multiplicity. He has a sort of an ontology that posits like multiple things in the universe, and there is an irrational aspect to the universe as well. Whereas that will get rejected later on. And if you remember from the Augustine episode, one of the questions is like, well, if God exists, how can there be evil? How can there be disorder? How can there be chaos? And the Neoplatonic idea, which Augustine picks up, is that those things don't actually exist. They're just an absence of God. And so in this instance, it would be, the response might be, well, it's not that chaos actually exists. It's not its own force. It's just an absence of the rational force. Right. It's an absence of love.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's something that I don't think it gets explicitly mentioned by Socrates, but it does sort of fit in the gaps of his arguments that would come about. You can see when we get to Socrates and he talks about that you would end up at that Neoplatonic and then Augustinian idea.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I've sort of jumped ahead in the history of thought there, but it is interesting that you see that evolution.
But to just kind of cap off Eryximachus, honestly, there's not too much more there.
No.
He also has this idea of like heavenly love and then common love. He extends that idea. It's like heavenly love is for the improvement of another, and then common love is prone to self-indulgence. So are you loving for someone else, or are you loving for yourself? So again, this is, like, you can see this is a dichotomy of like pure erotic desire versus like a romantic sense of love mixed with erotic desire. That's a higher sort of love. And actually, there is an interesting part here where he says that impiety to your family and the gods is born of indulging common love. So when you kind of center your life around the sort of self-indulgence, like indulging your own desires and chasing pleasure, you're going to, you know, neglect your sort of duties to your own family, and you've got to neglect your duties to the gods because you're focused purely on yourself. When you're focused on this higher sort of love, like by extension, you're going to, you know, be focused on things that are outside yourself, and you want to see virtue in all these other important things in your life.
Yeah, it's interesting because you sort of see in this an idea that is still prevalent today. Sort of like our very first episode, Ethics of Authenticity, there's a bit in there that's referring to that sort of that discourse that's sort of, Lash and the culture of narcissism and this like cultural criticism of Western modernity as being like decadent and hedonistic, and really what it boils down to is self-absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
And that our culture now is much more accepting, perhaps even praising, of people who live purely for themselves, are purely self-focused, and just pursue their own desires without a sense of, this is not actually a higher good. This is just the pleasures of the flesh.
Mm.
And that sort of gets lost in contemporary liberalism. But you see, it's a very ancient idea that common love and chasing desire because it's fleeting will lead you to ruin, and it's not the source of a happy life.
This is why we have to return to the ancients, folks.
We do have to return to the ancients. As Confucius said, I am wise because I've read the ancients.
There you go. So I think that pretty much caps off Eriximachus. And then we move on to Aristophanes, who was, I feel like he's probably one of the most famous figures in the dialogue, because he was a playwright. And, you know, yeah. We still have his work surviving today. And I note as well that he's possibly taking the piss.
Yeah.
But for non-Australian listeners, that means like he's joking around, he's being sarcastic.
Yeah.
Because he does have a sort of ridiculous argument going on here.
It's kind of nice though. Like the moral of the story is kind of nice.
Yeah, it's got a nice moral, but it's Aristophanes, it's worth noting, wrote a play where he was sort of poking fun at Socrates, like they were contemporaries.
Mm.
And he wrote this play called The Clouds, where it's like Socrates like lived in this basket in the sky, so he just had his head in the clouds all the time.
Right.
And Plato, being the biggest follower of Socrates, writes this after Aristophanes is dead and attributes to him this sort of ridiculous idea, which I think there's an element of like, yeah, what are you going to do now, mate?
Yeah. he had the last laugh.
Yeah.
Although, like, it is a ridiculous story, but I kind of liked it. So basically, Aristophanes says that originally there were three genders, the male, which is represented by the sun, female, which is represented by earth, and then there were those who were androgynous, and so they were a mixture of both, and that's the moon, because apparently the moon is a combination of both the sun and the earth. Mm-hmm. Basically, humans had eight limbs. We had four legs, four arms, and we had a head that had a face on the front and the back.
And we were like big sort of circles.
We were big circles. Yeah.
Hang on, I'll read this out to make it a little clearer. For another thing, the shape of each human being was a rounded hole with back and sides forming a circle. Each one had four hands and the same number of legs, and two identical faces on a circular neck. They had one head for both the faces, which were turned in opposite directions, four ears, two sets of genitals, and everything else was as you would imagine from what I've said so far. They moved around upright as we do now, in either direction as they wanted. When they set off to run fast, they would support themselves on all their eight limbs and moved quickly round and round, like tumblers who do cartwheels, by keeping their legs straight as they go round and round.
Yeah.
So that's how we used to be.
That's a true account, true and factual account of human evolution. And so apparently we had no limit to our ambition when we were in this state. And so we basically attacked the gods. And then they were like, shit, well, we don't want to get rid of humans because then who's going to give us tributes and sacrifices? So Zeus had this excellent idea that will make humans weaker and we'll actually make more of them. We will cut them in half. And so Zeus cuts all the humans in half. And so that's why we have two legs, two arms, one face, one set of genitals, etc. But what makes this so interesting is that because we were originally this circular creature and we've been cut in half, we are always longing to find our other half, right? And so Aristophanes talks about how they would basically run towards each other and embrace, trying to be together again. But then humans would die. That's all they were doing. Mm. So God then moved our genitals from our front to our back. So at least when we embraced, we would reproduce and create more humans.
Checks out.
But remember that there were three genders. So those who were male before they were split, they're attracted to other men. And so they run around and try and embrace other men. Females, same. That's females who were split into two are attracted to other females. And then if you're androgynous, you can go either way, which is interesting because you would think that there would be less, just statistically one out of three, you'd think there'd be less androgynous people. So it does give some indication of just how different the views were about sexuality back then. But yeah, because we were split in half, we are running around trying to find our other half, which I think is kind of beautiful.
Yeah. It's very poetic.
It's very poetic. And it says, love is the name for the desire and pursuit of wholeness, and we can only reach happiness if we find our loved one and restore our original nature.
Love makes you whole. And it's important here. This is something I note that gets picked up by Socrates in his section, which is the idea that love, in a sense, human nature is marked by lack. Like, there is a lack of something inherent to the human condition, and that part of the purpose, part of the meaning of a human life is to fulfill that lack. So this is how Aristophanes accounts for it. Like, we've been split off from our other half, and that by finding our other half, we become whole again.
Yeah.
But love is the pursuit of something that's going to fill that lack.
It's a pursuit of wholeness.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the back of this book, it talks about the lasting effect that this dialogue has had on even modern society's view on love. I mean, and you can just see it in sort of like the sayings that we have in our society, that, you know, when you find someone and they complete you, or they're your other half or your better half, right? So this view has survived. I don't know whether it comes from this, but it's... Obviously, you can see how these sort of ideas remain in the culture.
Yeah, and I just got a quote here because this draws in really nicely to Augustine. Love is the name for the desire and pursuit of wholeness, which if we think back to the Augustine episode and talk about Augustine's, like, his, like, mystical descriptions of, like, the mystical encounter with God, where he wants to sort of give himself up to, like, the holy light and, like, dissolve himself and go into oneness with God. He wants to subsume himself completely in God and become whole with Him. Like this is where that idea comes from.
Yeah.
Also, there's a section here where Aristophanes mentions that those original humans who were split off and were male in gender and are attracted to other men only are more masculine for doing so. Because they are naturally the bravest. They're bold, brave, and masculine, and welcome the same qualities in others. So helps sort of indicate towards this cultural idea in ancient Greece that, like, you become more masculine through associating with other men, as well as in, like, including, like, homosexual relationships. Like, that makes you more manly.
Yeah. Gay men are more manly.
That's it. What else is going on in Aristophanes? Is there anything else you wanted to mention for his part?
I didn't really take my notes by name. So after this, is it Aristophanes or is it someone else who actually says, no, love is the youngest god?
Yeah, I think that's when we get to Agathon. But actually, I got two things I want to mention for Aristophanes. It says that romantic love, is like a key part of human nature. So not just like, you know, part of like being a human being is to find a romantic lover with whom to become whole again. Like, you got to find someone. And like the best you can do absent finding your like literal other half is to find a loved one who naturally fits your own character. Is that way you're not in discord with one another and you can help develop one another.
Yeah.
Then we move on to Agathon.
It's his party, right? It's his house.
Yeah. So there would be like annual or biannual festivals in ancient Greece for a variety of things. And some of them are about competitions of poets. So the reason for the season, the occasion at hand, is because Agathon, who's a tragic poet, won his first sort of Greece-wide contest for tragic poetry.
I'm going to pretend I already knew that, guys. I'm learning as much as you.
So they're all celebrating at Agathon's place because, you know, he won the gold medal there.
Oh well, good on him.
Yeah. So, yeah, he starts off eulogizing the god Eros, who contra what was mentioned by Phaedrus at the beginning through Hesiod,
yeah,
is not in fact one of the oldest gods. He is one of the youngest ones.
Yeah, I mean, this was another sort of weird speech where I was kind of hard pressed to see what the philosophical import was. But love is the happiest god. I mean, that's kind of obvious. Love makes us happy. Love is the youngest god. But what was interesting was that love is soft. Love doesn't use force. And love also possesses the greatest amount of moderation. And so basically when people do what love says, they're not coerced into doing it. There's always consent, which is, yeah, an interesting idea.
Yeah. Definitely in a philosophical sense, I think this was the least fruitful one. But it is, I feel like intentionally it's like the most sort of like literary and poetic.
Mm.
Like he's not going through like... you know, like formal arguments here. He's saying like, love is like this. Love is like that. Love inspires this in us. Love cannot be directed at ugliness. Love drains us of estrangement and fills us with familiarity, causing us to come together in shared gatherings. And
I love that quote.
Yeah. There is some beautiful stuff in this, but it's not like strictly philosophical. Like it's intentionally structured to be like a poetic sort of understanding.
Yeah.
Because he is the poet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
True.
All right. But I feel like it's important to stress that last point. Love cannot be directed at ugliness, which is another thing that gets picked up by Socrates in his section.
Mm.
Was there anything else you wanted to mention for Agathon?
No, that's my last note for him was that quote, love drains us of estrangement and fills us with familiarity, which I really liked.
Okay, so now we get to the big dog.
Socrates.
Who starts out in, you know, classic Socrates fashion, where he goes, look, I'm the dumbest guy in the room. Agathon, mate, why don't you, like, humour me with a couple questions? I just want to ask some things about how you understand love.
Yeah, he's like, how could I possibly follow these great speeches? Like, I'm going to be lost for words.
Yeah, and ends up completely picking it apart and making Agathon look like an idiot.
Yeah. I love the tactic, though. It's like, Agathon, because you're so much smarter than me, like, why don't I ask you a few questions? Because you could tell me.
Yeah. But he, through the course of this sort of discourse with Agathon, he shows it to be sort of an inconsistent understanding and sort of railroads Agathon. I've been reading The Republic as well, and I've noticed Socrates does this a lot in Plato's dialogues, where he will railroad his interlocutors into a specific argument or view that they may not necessarily hold.
Yeah, and sorry to cut you off. It really pisses me off because I don't actually think that, like, I mean, ironically, I don't actually think it's a fruitful debate tactic to really find out what someone else thinks.
Yeah.
Because you're kind of sort of twisting their arm
semantically
to get them to be like, yeah, that's what I think, I guess. And then you knock it down. But as you just said, like, you really kind of just force someone into this position.
Yeah. Though it does get mentioned in The Republic because at the start he's talking with someone named Thrasymachus.
Yeah.
And Thrasymachus,
this wild beast.
Yeah, he's listening to Socrates talk for a while, and he's like, "No, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's not right." And Plato presents Thrasymachus as just like this boorish, he's like a kind of rude, inappropriate guy.
Yeah,
but his whole thing is like, dude, like, stop railroading me into an argument. That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, it literally is like if you watch. Is it Vosh or Vau? I can't remember. I'm not deliberately mispronouncing his name because I think he's a prick, but like that guy, that like American Twitch stream, I think it's Vosh.
I've heard of him, but I intentionally keep myself away from him.
That's what he does, right? And it's that sort of like debate lord tactic where you really are actually not listening to what the other person is saying. You focus on how you could possibly construe their arguments to seem illogical. Do they use, like, the wrong word? It just seems really disingenuous. It's like...
It's a real Reddit comment, motherfucker.
Yeah, exactly. It's like how people argue on Reddit. And frankly, people might hate me for saying this, but it's like, it's what Christopher Hitchens used to do. Mm. People think he was, like, this savant, this, like, absolute genius. But you, I don't know, man, you go back and watch him, And it's like so much of this is just straw manning.
Yeah, it's sophistry.
It literally is sophistry. I mean, I'm not saying Socrates is a sophist, but like there's parts of his way of argumentation which I just find really...
He's informed by the sophist tradition.
That's true. He's reacting against it. Yeah. So he's, as you say, he's necessarily informed by it. It would be hard for him to make a complete break.
Yeah, but actually when we get to the end of his sort of discourse with Agathon where he's picking apart what he was saying... Agathon goes like, look, Socrates, it looks as though I didn't know what I was talking about. And Socrates goes, oh, this is a beautiful speech, blah, blah, blah. And then asks him one more question. And then Agathon replies with, I can't argue against you, Socrates. Let's accept that things are as you say. And I feel like this next part is like metatextual. Like I just get the sense this is Plato talking to the reader through Socrates.
Mm.
Where he says, it's the truth you can't argue against, my dear friend Agathon. It's not at all difficult to argue against Socrates.
Yeah.
So I feel like there is...
You think I get the Plato's sense there's slightly taking the piss?
No, I get that there's an intentional element in how like Plato is structuring Socrates' arguments so that there are like some obvious flaws in how he does things, and part of his project is to like, you know, present that so you can also pick apart Socrates while you're reading the text. I feel like that's a real like a wink when he says that.
Interesting.
It's not at all difficult to argue against Socrates.
yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a bit of breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah. But anyway, getting on to the Socrates discussion, he frames his contributions to the dialogue through an interaction with a character who was like a priestess or a seer named Diotima, who is this sort of like a religious figure, and later on, deeper into his discussion with Diotima, he mentions that there's, I'll read this quote, and this is like from deeper into it. Even you, Socrates, could perhaps be initiated in the rites of love I've described so far, but the purpose of these rites, if they are performed correctly, is to reach the final vision of the mysteries, and I'm not sure you could manage this. Which I feel like that and then what Socrates goes on to sort of caps off this through line in the dialogue from that ancient mythic understanding through like Hesiod and Homer and whatnot through to Socrates' like rational understanding. Because this was like a big thing in ancient Greece was like mystery cults.
Mm.
So there would be these religious cults. Like it's the understanding of a lot of scholars nowadays that the worship of, like, say, Zeus or, like, Athena or Apollo, these were, like, state gods, like, gods that represent a certain city-state. And through worshipping them, it's sort of like a civic sense of religion. But for, like, the more transcendent forms of religion, you would go towards these mystery cults where there would be a process. You become an initiate and you move through these ranks and reach higher and higher states of knowledge from the people who are at the sort of hierarchy of this mysterious cult. And it seems that's what Socrates is recounting here in his relationship with Diotima, because he mentions that he recounts it in one go, but he says like this takes place in like numerous conversations over time. And Diotima even mentions like, look, you're an initiate, there are certain like mysteries here, but look, I'll reveal it to you. I'll reveal the final mystery. But through that we get to Socrates sort of like final rationalized understanding, which is in part mystical when we get to it. You know, there's a sort of religious element to it, but it's religion informed like completely rationally. It's like informed through Socrates and Plato's dialectical method. So we've gone from that like purely mythical element at the start to now there's still that sort of religious sort of mythical grounding, but it's fully justified through rational philosophical thought.
Mm.
This is where that reaches a crescendo through Socrates.
Yeah, absolutely. So we mentioned that Socrates knocks down, he kind of arm twists Agathon into showing that his view was contradictory. So how does he do that? Just briefly, he goes, well, you know, we love the good, et cetera, et cetera. And he goes, well, wouldn't you agree that no one loves what they have? They only love what they don't want. And he goes, well, yeah, sure. He goes, well, how can love love the good? Because love is good. So you either have to say that love is not good, which you're not prepared to say, or that love doesn't have the good. So he goes, oh, well, I guess that doesn't make any sense, right? So then he recounts his discussion with Diotima. And Diotima goes, well, you're assuming that you're sort of presenting this dichotomy between like wisdom and ignorance, for example, because it's not the case that you're either wise or ignorant. There's something in the middle. And that's an inch. He goes, knowledge without reason. So if I just make a guess and it turns out to be right, I'm not ignorant, but I'm also not wise because I can't give reasons for my knowledge. And Diotima says, love is neither a god nor a human. It's in the middle. It's a spirit. It talks. It relays messages between between gods and humans. So Diotima sort of twists out of Socrates' logical objection and says that he's made the mistake of talking about love as the object of love, right? So love as being the good thing that we desire for. She also says, no, love is the lover. Love is like the act of loving. It's not the thing that you love per se. So there's that. And then they agree that the object of people's love is the good. Remember, that's love is not the good. That's our object of love. But also that we desire to have the good forever, right? Because Socrates earlier says, well, we don't love what we already have. So let's just say, for example, that you love being rich. Well, if you are rich, that's what you really mean by that is you desire to be rich in the future because you might not have riches in the future. So they agree that love is the desire to have the good forever. But that's the object of love. So what is love itself? Well, love is a function. Love enables us to give birth to beauty, right? And in doing so, in giving birth, in reproduction, that is how humans, these fleeting mortal creatures, come closest to immortality in the process of reproduction. And that's true in both senses. It's true in the physical sense, so sexual reproduction. In creating offspring, we sort of ensure the immortality of our species. But it's also true in this higher rational sense when people come together and discover love itself, love the form, and they see love in not just physical things but in ideas, and they engage in these discourses and they produce these works of art, these works of philosophy. They are giving birth to virtue and beauty, which is immortal, which outlives them. So the function of love is to create immortality.
Yeah. And it's in getting to this, he draws on the ideas of all the previous people in some way, like for that part about like physical reproduction, like that's draws on Eric Symmachus, who was talking about like love as a physical process. Mm. Like, yeah, love is reproduction, but it's reproduction in the sense of like going towards immortality. And also earlier from like Phaedrus, like there is a virtue sense to love because you want something immortal, but to do that, you have to act virtuously to be able to even interact with people to create something that's immortal. And then Pausanias, where he talks about heavenly and common love, and there's a higher immortal form of love, which is like through ideas and like apprehension of like immortal things.
Mm.
And there's also, when we get to Diotima's part, Diotima through Socrates, she does talk about this sort of linguistic confusion. And I'm not sure how this would have looked in the Greek, but it was translated like, what we're doing is picking out one kind of love and applying to it the name love that belongs to the whole class, while we use different names for other kinds of love. So she does point out here, like, yeah, we've been talking about Eros this whole time, or at least like love, but like there's other sorts of phenomena that are going on here, indicating towards different sorts of things. Mm. But then we get, yeah, she also mentions that the idea of like Aristophanes, like the idea has been put forward that lovers are people who are looking for their own other halves. But she goes, well, no, it's not. Yeah, like, it's not the other half in the sense of, like, any other half of a person, you're looking to fill that part of yourself that is empty with something that is like good and beautiful and eternal, right? You are filling yourself in some way. You are, human nature is defined by a lack in some sense, but we need to be careful about how we're characterizing what's going to fill that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, yeah, we get into that idea of like love is like reproductive. There's an interesting part where they go through the idea of like not, you know, there's like physically reproductive love, but there's also like intellectually reproductive love. But also there are things like being a good ruler and like creating a new like method of political organization or creating good laws. That's an act and a product of love.
Yeah.
In this understanding. And
because there's beauty in good laws. There's beauty in good institutions.
Yeah, like it's through doing so, you reach a sort of immortality.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you would, the people who brought about those good laws and institutions are remembered through time.
Yeah.
So that in itself is an act of love because you want to reach something that is immortal.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned there's physical reproduction and there's also like this sort of intellectual reproduction. And this is fascinating because this is, you know, people have heard about platonic love and platonic relationships and that is what is being spoken about here, where Diotima says, well, people who are lucky enough to find a mind that is beautiful, you're strongly drawn to them. And what happens when you find someone else, when you find a beautiful mind, you find that they have the resources to talk about virtue and what a good man should be like, etc. And so I'm going to read a direct quote here. It is, I think, when someone has made contact and formed a relationship with beauty of this sort that he gives birth to and reproduces the child with which he has long been pregnant. He thinks about the other's beauty, whether they are in each other's company or not, and together with him he shares in bringing up the child reproduced in this way. People like that have a much closer partnership with each other and a stronger bond of friendship than parents have, because the children of their partnership are more beautiful and more immortal. So the child here that Diotima is talking about, and is, if you're a person who is pregnant in mind, that is, you're pregnant with this, I guess, like a creative potential or an intellectual potential, and then you find someone who is an intellectual equal of you, and through this coming together of minds, you give birth to, I don't know, be it a work of philosophy, a work of art, you create this child which is more immortal than a human child for obvious reasons. And then she goes on to give the example of Homer and Hesiod. People look enviously at Homer and Hesiod and other good poets because of the kind of children they have left behind them, which provide them with immortal fame and remembrance by being immortal themselves.
Yeah, and that's even more true today than it was back then, because at the time, Plato would be about like a 200-300 year remove from Homer and Hesiod, and where, God, how far away is that? That's like almost 3,000 years from then, so that holds up.
Yeah, I'm still talk about Homer and the Iliad and et cetera.
Yeah. And before that sort of discussion, Diotima mentions a view of personal identity that I thought was very interesting, because she says, like, a human being is marked by flux and change. Like, we say that someone is said to be the same from childhood to old age, but, you know, everything about you physically changes over, and everything about you mentally changes over as well. Like, you have different skin, like hair, bones, blood, his whole body, but also like your attributes, character traits, beliefs, desires, pleasures, pains, fears. None of these ever remain the same in each of us, but some are emerging while others are being lost. So human nature, like being a physical human, is like marked by flux. Which is, you can see the influence of the pre-Socratic philosopher Heraclitus here, because we only have fragments surviving of his, and they're sort of like aphorisms. He has this famous quote: "A man never steps in the same river twice."
Yeah,
like the universe is marked by flux. Things are ever changing. And we can see how Plato and Socrates sort of draw in this idea to go, physical things are marked by flux, but there is something eternal beyond that that isn't physical.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that's how, that's a, very much a response to that.
Mm.
So we would naturally wonder, how does one go from being a lover or a desirer of the merely material world, that which is fleeting, being a lover of body? How do you go from being a lover of body to being a lover of mind? And this is where Diotima talks about the correct way for someone to approach the business of loving beauty itself. And this is quite interesting because this is where you get an exposition of the idea of the form of beauty. And so Diotima talks about how, well, first, and ideally this should be when you're a child, you should love just one body. And then over time you realize that the beauty in that body is not inherent to that body, but rather that any body that is beautiful is sharing in the same form of beauty. So logically, you should then love multiple bodies. And then you move from there to realizing that the beauty which you find in bodies, you can actually find in non-physical things. And you realize that the beauty of minds is much more valuable than the beauty of the body. And you see that similar sort of beauty in things like laws and institutions and practices. They themselves have a form of beauty. And you go from there, you stop looking at beauty, you start looking at beauty in general, not just individual instances of beauty. Diotima gives a beautiful quote where she says, "Instead of this low and small-minded slavery, he will be turned towards the great sea of beauty, and gazing on it, he'll give birth through a boundless love of knowledge to many beautiful and magnificent discourses and ideas." And you begin, you see beauty itself, this sort of great sea of beauty, which is the form of beauty. And when you see this, when you see beauty itself, it's then that you produce, you become truly virtuous because you've seen this form of beauty.
Which is, quote, the ultimate objective of all the previous efforts.
Exactly. And in doing, and in so doing so, in being virtuous, once you've seen the form of beauty, you come the closest that you can possibly come as a mortal human to immortality.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's, you start out loving physical things and then physical things in general and then mental things in general. And then you go from that to the idea of beauty, like the absolute, unchanging, immortal form or idea of beauty that undergirds all the specific instances. So you go from the particular to the, you know,
to the general,
to the general, to the universal, which, you know, thinking back to Augustine, is pretty much how he conceptualizes God and your relationship to God.
Yeah.
You know, God is like the unchanging, absolute beauty and goodness. And as well, like, keep in mind that in Socrates' discussion here through Diotima, I've lost my pronunciation, she draws like a connection between what is beautiful and what is good and what is wise and what is virtuous. You know, they all sort of indicate towards the same thing. And through orienting yourself towards that, you are able to cultivate all those different things. You're able to cultivate beauty and wisdom and goodness and whatnot.
Yeah.
They're all of a sort.
Yeah. So it's an interesting idea because I guess in contemporary thought, you know, we often say that, like, from Hume, you can't get an ought from an is, or that science can tell us the way that the world is, but it doesn't tell us anything about morality. Whereas to the ancient, I shouldn't say the ancient Greeks, but like to Plato and sort of philosophers of this bent, truth, beauty, knowledge, the good, morality, what you find is that they're actually all just the same thing. There is this fundamental unity. They're all emanating from the same source, which, as you say, in Augustine, is God.
Right. And also, like I mentioned in Augustine, is very similar to at least how I understand and how I've heard Hinduism is.
Mm.
You know, the undergirding reality is, you know, the realization that's undergirding all particulars is a universal, and that the true sort of like spiritual existential culmination of a human life is to realize that universal and, you know, worship it and live in accordance with it.
Yeah.
Which really, again, really interesting that this is a common thread through different traditions.
And if you don't like the religious language,
you suck.
Yeah. Get over yourself. No, think of it like the theory that like the universe is a simulation.
Mm.
I mean, you can sort of use that analogy or that thought experiment to get at a similar idea about what the Greeks are concerned with, the problem of the one and the many. And if you think about the universe as being a computer simulation, well, ultimately everything that we see, although it appears as though it's all different, it's all just ones and zeros.
Yeah.
It's all coming from the same source. We all come from this one source.
Tomato sauce.
Tomato sauce.
Simulation theory is pretty much like the modern day, like, Stembro version of Plato's theory of the cave.
Well, dude, like,
yeah,
man, The Matrix is such a good film.
Yeah.
There's so much philosophical allusion in The Matrix.
Yeah. This is something I wouldn't mind doing for the pod. In The Matrix, it's a lot of allusions to Baudrillard, simulacra and simulation.
Yeah, and Gnostic Christianity as well.
Yeah. We should do Baudrillard at some point.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, 100%.
But anyways, so Diotima finishes up by, you know, going to, like, there's a hierarchy of love, and the highest point is love of, like, unchanging absolute beauty, like the form of love. And through getting to that final form, it's the closest to immortality we can get. Because then we act in a truly virtuous way, and we are like, we have oriented our lives towards the truly immortal. Like, we're not going towards any form of a particular good, like creating good laws or good ideas. You know, absolute beauty is the closest to immortality that we can ever get. That is the one true immortal thing. And through doing that, we've hit the top, and we've got the closest we can get to immortality.
Mm.
Which kind of finishes up the dialogue, and then they get this symposium, this drinking party gets interrupted by a gentleman called Alcibiades, which a very famous Athenian statesman. I think if you've read Thucydides, I think. Oh, God, I'm pretty sure it's Thucydides. He is a... not a character because it's a history, but he plays a part in there. And he pretty much like drunk gate crashes this party.
Yeah.
And is very, very resentful and kind of like making fun, like insulting / lamenting the fact that he can't get with Socrates.
Quite literally that Socrates won't sleep with him.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Which I'm sure that there's got to be some sort of esoteric bent to this, that we can find some underlying ideas in here, but I wasn't able to penetrate this. I just thought it was funny.
Well, he was not able to penetrate it either.
Nice.
And with that, Alex is putting away his books.
All right, look, that's as good a thing as we can end on.
Yeah, it's all right. Thanks for listening, folks. We love you. We love your minds.
Hugs and kisses.
We love you platonically, because that is the highest form. If you enjoyed this, please share it, promote it. Most importantly, please give us a rating on your favorite podcast listening platform.
Ratings and recommendations.
Yes, the two R's, please.
Yep. All right, thanks, everyone.
Thank you.